Yeah, I won't make my slide. I don't have too many slides, and I won't be too wordy with my talk. So, but if you have questions or anything, just ask. It's not going to be like me talking to you one sided. So let's like make some interactive thing. But okay, so in terms of internet technologies, things have becoming more and more epical, and our digital technologies have been growing in their scope over the years. And today I'm going to tell you about a system which I think really has massive repercussions for not only free software and our peer-to-peer systems, but also in our societal constructs. It goes way beyond the realm of the digital. Today's computers are mindless slaves, but they are rapidly becoming immensely powerful and versatile systems. This is bringing about the greatest revolution that the human race has ever known, a revolution that will enhance the value of human talent but diminish the value of unskilled human labor. This revolution could lead to terrible consequences, or it could lead to the greatest advances ever for the human race. Which of these things is to happen is up to us. So Stallman wrote telegraphically. Stallman wrote telegraphically in the 80s that the free software movement aims for the liberation of cyberspace and everyone in it. So to understand the future, we have to understand the present. And to understand the present, we have to understand the past. And we're reminded of Philip Zimmermann, an anti-nuclear activist, the creator of PGP, which was the world's first freely available encryption software for the people. And at the start of the 90s, when PGP was released, encryption only really was, in the realm of spy agencies. Governments classified encryption as a weapon. And there was this massive outcry when Zimmermann dared to release this dangerous technology for the average person to use. In February 1993, Zimmermann became the formal target of a criminal investigation by the US government for munitions export without a license. That was a really serious crime. The penalties for violation, if Zimmermann was found guilty, were really substantial. Zimmermann stood accused of the export of weapons, cryptography. Cryptography in this case was in the same class as missiles and fighter jets. Zimmermann ended up challenging these regulations in a very curious way. What he did is he published the entire source code for PGP in a hardback book, and you could buy the book via MIT Press. And this book was distributed and sold widely. Anybody who wished to build their own copy of PGP could buy this $60 book. You could cut off the covers, you could separate the pages, and you could scan them in using an OCR scanner. And that way, from those scanned in pages, you could create source code from the text files. And then you could build the application using the freely available GCC, the GNU compiler collection. And in that way, it could be available anywhere in the world. The claim principle was very simple. It was that the export of munitions, such as guns, bombs, planes, and software, was restricted. But the export of books was protected by the First Amendment. The investigation that Zimmermann was under was closed, and no criminal charges were filed against him. And now we fast forward a decade and a half, and virtually everybody on the net uses encryption all of the time, for everything from secure ordering to online banking to sending private love letters. It's a somewhat naive vision of a lone computer programmer in Colorado who is at the heart of this extremely sensible and practical global revolution in privacy technologies. So Zimmermann made a lot of the systems that we're building today possible, and in particular Bitcoin. what is Bitcoin? Bitcoin is democratic money. It is the first time that we have a decentralized digital currency. And I cannot emphasize more than enough that it is a decentralized system. Out of the fact that it is decentralized, all of these amazing properties emerge. It is a system that is built not off of laws and legislation that are corruptible by people, but off of mathematics and cryptography. It is an algorithmic system, a system that functions according to codes, written mathematical codes. So, one of the things is that because it is a mathematical system, it is incorruptible. It can't have anyone come along and print more money or change the rules at whim, which is something that totalitarian governments and regimes have done for decades. It is in Zimbabwe now that the Mugabe is printing, inflating the currency at a huge rate. They have a massive amounts of inflation because that's how they fund their wars of genocide. And the same story in Iran. And even here in Europe, the same thing happened when Europe had some of the worst inflation ever seen, when Milosevic was inflating the monetary supply so he could wage his wars of genocide. And even in January this year, the German government approved 80 billion euros in another bailout fund for banks. And it's like there's an organization that's really important to the human, to the future of humanity. And what they do is they take people into space. I'm talking about NASA. And they put people on the moon. They take us back to the beginnings of the creation of the universe, back to the start of the Big Bang. And now they're talking about building colonies on Mars. And they have funding problems. And the cost of a mission to Mars would cost, NASA's budget is 10 billion euros per year. And a mission to Mars would take 10 years, a decade, well within the budget of NASA. And instead we just give away, you know, just 80 billion euros to the bank, just like that, you know? It's ludicrous. And even in the financial industry, there's a ton of corruption. Well, 6 months ago, I was in Amsterdam, and I wanted to change $2,000 of my money into GBP, into pounds. And I went everywhere, and the only two places that would do it were Western Union and MoneyGram. And they're exactly the same. And they say, oh, there's no fee. But when you look at the spread between the buy and the sell, you're paying 20%. 20% just for someone to sit behind a desk and type in some numbers. So to send $2,000, I have to pay $400. That's fucking outrageous and obscene. So let's have a demo of this Bitcoin system. So, one second. Right. Don't know if you can see this. I'm using IRC, which is a chat program. I'm sure many of you know what IRC is. Saying, Genjix, what is your Bitcoin address? And so he replied back, where's my mouse? Like, there it is. Copy. Let's just open a terminal. How do I do this? All right. Bitcoin, send, paste the address, and I think I'll send two bitcoins. boom, just sent $10 to Japan. No fees, no middlemen, no central parties. So what are the properties of a system like Bitcoin? So I mentioned before that it's decentralized. I really cannot emphasize this more than enough. It is because it's, you know, this decentralized system that you get transparency, that it's against the process being corrupted. It cannot be corrupted. And it's a system because it's fully automatic, working according to, natural principles of mathematics, that it's, you know, always running 24 hours, 7 days a week. There are no bank holiday Mondays, you know, no shut-out weekends. It's functioning all the time. It's like how we live in the 20th century. I mean, come on, like, my bank closes at the weekend. What the fuck? And very low fees. You know, I just sent that $10 to Japan at no fees. That's pretty incredible. And because it is a system that functions, because there's no human aspect to make it work, it is not a system that's based on web of trust, it is completely mathematically based, there is really no concept of borders. Even if we wanted to include, you know, some restrictions according to borders, it would be impossible because it's not an engineering principle. So it's international. And also, let's put that on our list, international. And I think it's really unfair that people across the world are segmented into these different groups according to nationality. So I have a friend in Iran, and he contributes a massive amount to free software. But because of one spat that one government has with another government, I'm talking here about the US government and the Iranian government, he cannot participate in the global economy. He's shut out because of, you know, something between governments. And it's not the governments that suffer, it's the people. People suffer because of trade embargoes or artificial barriers to entry into the markets. You know? It's like there is an enormous amount of people who have family that live in the UK, like Indian people who have family that work in the UK, and there is a huge market of remittance, which is where they send money back home to family or friends. And, you know, if I brought up that story of Western Union earlier, if you imagine what it's like in the West where we have consumer protection laws, we have AML laws, you can only imagine what it's like for someone in developing country where they don't have this kind of legal protection. It's not really a fair system. A lot of the regulation, in fact, is very short-sighted and ends up actually harming and introducing all these false costs into the market, except for people who have that huge level of capitalization. It's, you know, punishing the workers in the UK who are sending funds to their family in India. And another thing about Bitcoin is it has a very strong privacy model. So the privacy model for how the banks function is you have a beneficiary and a depositor. You make a payment to someone, and it goes through those institutions, and they know the parties to that transaction. But all of the details for that transaction are kept separate from the public. By contrast, Bitcoin's privacy system is different. It's all of the transactions are public, but the identities and the endpoints are separate. So when I went to open a personal bank account in here in Berlin, I the guy gave me like some paper to sign, and there were like three different companies I have to sign my I have to give approval for them to share my private details with. And it's like, those companies aren't even banks. They're like, they're just retail. And there was one organization that he showed me called Shkufa. And man, they had my name, my address, my telephone number. I never signed those details over to them. And I was like saying to him, yeah, look, you know, I don't want to sign these. I want to take this away and see, look up these companies. And he's like, no, you can't take that away. Because that's a classic tactic that banks use. When we were dealing with banks last year, they would not let us, they would not put anything into writing, they would not put anything into email, they would only do things over the telephone. And they do that to reduce liability on their end. It's a way of shirking their responsibility. And so I was like, yeah, okay then, I don't want to open a bank account. And the guy's like, all pissy, like, oh, you've wasted my time. But, well, fuck them. So Bitcoin can even be go beyond privacy. It can go to anonymity. That you can do things. They're not really built into the system yet because nobody's actually built them to actually make Bitcoins more anonymous. And there is actually now a drugs market on tour where you can buy drugs using Bitcoins and have them shipped to your house. And last year, a US Senator, Chuck Schumer, came out attacking Bitcoin, saying, oh, you know, Bitcoin is a scheme for drug trafficking networks and whatever crazy stuff, whatever. He doesn't understand the massive social benefit that a system like this can bring. Well, he's old anyway, so... I don't mean you, though. You're not old. And it's still going. They can't do shit. They can't do anything. Like, the way the Silk Road works is they actually wash the money internally using a laundering mechanism, so which obfuscates the inputs and outputs that makes it impossible to trace the Bitcoin payments. So nobody can know what people are doing with the money, and you know, and it's using Tor, and Tor is like anonymous in its own way. So, and that's a very active market. They do probably maybe, I don't know, this is a guess, based on some rules of thumb I've done, maybe more than $10 million a year in transactions. And also, talking of statistics, Bitcoin is the biggest digital currency that exists right now. There is no competitor. We talk about something like PayPal, but PayPal is not a digital currency, they're a payment processor. They are like the current monetary financial system with a small layer in cyberspace. They are not a digital money, which is something that Bitcoin is. I don't really think there has been a digital money that has been as successful as Bitcoin. Facebook credits, yeah. But you have to pay 30% per transaction. So I don't see that going far. They are divisible. So there is a big topic right now, and that is how, you know, the internet, how can we fund creators on the internet? You know, it's very important that artists are paid and free software programmers. That's why I got into Bitcoin. So, yeah, how can we, and there's this, how can we fund the artists and creative workers? And there's this idea, this concept at the moment floating about of microtransactions. And that is something that Bitcoin is very apt and good at. It, as you saw here, it reduces the friction to send a payment. There's a very low cost for in terms of my time to send a payment. There was a few months ago an artist that I really liked. So you know how in documentaries the scientists sound very like poetic and worldly? This guy would take clips of from the science documentaries and mix them with classical music, and they're incredible. It's called Symphony of Science, and I was listening to these for a long time, and it really like changed, you know, changed something inside me. It like really affected me on a deep level, like no other music really has. And I said to him many times, I tried to donate to him like through PayPal, and I'd go and enter my name, my address, my date of birth, you know, my sex, my, you know, my preferences or you know, all of my details, my telephone number, a sample of blood, you know. And then I click and it wouldn't work. And eventually I was just like, fuck it. And I sent him an email and I was like, hey, do you want to accept bitcoins? And then he was like, sure, let me go and have a look. And then 20 minutes later he responded. He's like, yeah, sure. And just in a click, I sent him some bitcoins. And he put the address up on his site. And I came and checked a few months later. And he'd got dozens of Bitcoin donations. And it was so cool to me because not only was I able to show my appreciation for his work, but I was able to facilitate more people to pay him. And there's another group of people called Rap News. They also do very good, music. And they contacted me and said, hey, a lot of people have been asking us about Bitcoin. We want to partake in this revolutionary currency. And I said, okay. And they wrote like an announcement that we're accepting Bitcoin. We're joining the Bitcoin movement. And we put it up there on the internet. And by the end of the day, they had got $500 worth of Bitcoin donations. And that's really incredible because the Bitcoin community is so small. And the technology is so undeveloped. It's analogous to the early web, right? The early web, a lot of people, if you can read things from that time where people were saying, oh, the web is a fad. But the software hadn't been developed. The concepts hadn't been worked out yet. It's the same with Bitcoin. We're still working out the specifics to make it usable and easy to use. No, microtransactions are a very long topic. So I just got the next thing is secure. So one of the things is that Bitcoin's security policy is far superior to the alternatives. I am in charge of my own security policy. I don't have. I am not forced to rely on third parties, right? So it was Citibank 4 months ago was compromised, and 2% of Citibank's 21 million accounts, credit card accounts, were leaked on the internet. And PlayStation, 10 million of their credit card accounts were leaked on the internet. And with Bitcoin, sure, someone could break into a Bitcoin website and steal the Bitcoins, but they would not be able to steal your Bitcoins, and they would not be able to forge your identity because you keep that on your computer. All they would be able to do is steal the merchant's Bitcoins. So it's really putting the power and the privacy in the hands of people. And then this last one is... So a big problem with selling things on the internet is chargebacks, because there's something called friendly fraud, which makes it near impossible to sell digital content. When you pay for something on the internet, that cost is actually bigger than what it should be, because you're subsidizing all of the people who engage in friendly fraud. And what it is you can buy something on the internet and then pay using PayPal, and then contest that charge with PayPal. And PayPal will ask the person you bought it off for proof of delivery, which they won't have because it's a digital good. And then you request the payment back, and you have now the good and the payment. So there's a quote here that I'm going to read by Nicholas Taleb, in which he says that globalization creates interlocking fragility while reducing volatility and giving the appearance of stability. In other words, it creates devastating black swans. We have never lived before under the threat of global collapse. Financial institutions have been merging into a smaller number of very large banks. Almost all banks are interrelated. So the financial ecology is swelling into a gigantic, incestuous, bureaucratic banks. When one falls, they all fall. The increased concentration among banks seems to have the effect of making the financial crisis less likely. But when they happen, they are more global in scale. And they hit us very hard. We have moved from a diversified ecology of small banks with varied lending policies to a more homogeneous framework of firms that all resemble one another. True, we now have fewer failures, but when they occur, I shiver at the thought. The government-sponsored institution Fannie Mae, when I look at its risks, seems to be sitting on a barrel of dynamite, vulnerable to the slightest hiccup, but not to worry. Their large staff of scientists deems these events unlikely. It's like when we bail out failing companies, they are confiscating money from productive members of society and giving it to the failing ones. By sustaining companies with obsolete or unsustainable business models, the government prevents their resources from being liquidated and made available to other companies that can put them to better, more productive use. An essential element of a healthy free market is that both success and failure must be permitted to happen when they are earned. But instead, with a bailout, the rewards are reversed. The proceeds from successful entities are given to failing ones. Like, how is this supposed to be good for their economy is beyond me. It won't work. It can't work. It is obvious to most of us here that we need to reject corporate cronyism and allow the natural regulations and incentives to pick the winners and losers in our economy, not the whims of bureaucrats and politicians. So, is it possible that I can have sound on my laptop? Yeah? What do I plug in? I am well organized. La da da. It's here. All right, here we go. Ready? All right. Oh, there's no sound there. Let me try my volume. Yep, volume seems all right. Ah, there you go. My
You're incompetent. Infinitely free to follow their desires. Now in the 1990s, the technologies had been built. And in 1991, a leading computer engineer from California gave a dramatic demonstration. He was called Lauren Carpenter. He invited hundreds of people to a large shed. On each seat was a small paddle, and in front of them was a giant screen.
We told them nothing for a while. We just left the things on the seats, and people would pick this up and look at it and say, what's that? And then somebody noticed that there's little red and green dots up there on the screen, and this is red and green, so maybe that has something to do with that.
That would be that. Okay, there I am.
And when that happened, the room erupted. Just totally spontaneous. We didn't say anything.
Carpenter then began an experiment. He projected the early computer game Pong. Each half of the audience jointly controlled the bat on their side of the screen. If an individual held up red on their paddle, a computer sensor picked it up and the bat on the screen went down. If they held up green, it went up. But they had to operate it together.
When the game is being played and the ball is going back and forth, if it's down here and it's headed that way, some people are going to have to show red to keep it from going all the way to the top. If everybody just showed green, it would slam up to the top and the ball would miss. So something happened in that group of people where some decided to show green and some decided to show red to cause it to stop in the right place. And we have no idea what did that.
Carpenter believed that what he had created was a model of a society where there was no hierarchy, where everyone made their own decisions without guidance. Yet because they were linked by the machines, out of it came a stability and an order.
So they're all acting as individuals because each one of them can decide what they're going to do. They have total freedom of what to decide to do. But there's an order. There's an order that emerges that gives them a kind of an amoeba-like effect where they surge and they play. It was kind of in the nature of an experiment. I wanted to see if no hierarchy existed at all, what would happen.
And what did happen?
They formed a kind of a subconscious consensus.
So, in the early part of this century, the idea of a self-organizing network reemerged in what seemed to be its original radical form. Beginning in 2003, a wave of spontaneous revolution swept throughout Asia and Europe. In each case, hundreds of thousands of people flooded into the capitals of Georgia, the Ukraine, and Kyrgyzstan, and they forced the old corrupt leaders from power. In all of these cases, no one was seen to be in charge. But then journalists discovered that the internet had played a key role. It had brought millions of people together to create revolutions that had no guiding ideology except a desire for self-determination and freedom. That's the end of the talk. If you want to ask questions, there's mics in the middle.
Hi. So the answer might be related to the video you just showed, but nowadays governments use the banking system as a way to monitor people that earn more and people that earn less to pay taxes. How do you foresee that could be accomplished on Bitcoin? Because we should pay taxes, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's of course like we need to help support our infrastructure. But I think there is this general mistaken assumption nowadays that public goods have to also be goods that are sponsored by the state. Bitcoin is not really a monetary system. It exists like that in its popular conceptualization, but internally it's actually a distributed time-stamping contract system. And what you can do is you can make, for instance, a type of payment which can only be redeemed once it reaches a certain amount of money. And so what you could do is you can fund public infrastructure projects in that form. One of the things I was saying earlier about how dictators use the monetary system, you know, to engage in, you know, manipulation or wars, like it was in the past that when a king wanted to go to war, he couldn't just take that initiative himself. He had to raise the funds from among the people. That's where the saying "the power of the purse lies in the Congress." If you wanted to go to war, you needed the consent of your citizenship through their money. More questions?
Yeah. Well, I have a question about taxes too. How is Bitcoin treated for taxing purposes at the moment? Is it? Do you have to declare it in most countries as income, or how does that taxing system treat it in general?
Okay, so I can only speak for the UK because that's where I operate. In the UK, the law is that all of your assets, in terms of real value, are taxed. So it doesn't matter if you gave me comic books or playing cards. Those are taxable items that have to be converted into government fiat currency to pay your taxes.
Okay, and then there's also the issue that for counter-terrorism purposes, large transactions must be usually tracked. Doesn't that create legal problems for Bitcoin because you can't track those transactions in general?
All right, so you said two things there. The first is you're talking about anti-money laundering. Anti-money laundering law doesn't really do that much. So what it does, anti-money laundering law does not stop terrorists sending money. What it does is it makes it more difficult. And really, when you have a large sum of money, it's very easy to circumvent these restrictions. Really, the only types of money laundering it does is stop the low-level crime. Now, you said about, does Bitcoin have legal problems because of this? Well, the thing to realize about a government is not a single homogenous entity. It's many different departments. And in the UK, with the governments that we have been dealing with, we have seen that the cybercrimes police hates us. They went on, you know, Channel 4 and decried Bitcoin as something very illegal that must be shut down. But the FSA, which is a financial services authority in the UK, has been very positive towards Bitcoin. In fact, they've helped us out a lot by telling us which legislation applies to us, which doesn't, and giving us guidance.
So I actually don't have any question, but for the taxes, like, I actually have a company in Finland, and I have been doing Bitcoin projects for now 1 year, and last month was like, April was the first month I actually created some Bitcoin income. And I sent email to tax officials, and they said, like, don't hurry with it. If you have some income, you can implement like any kind of business model, just report it, and that's it. You don't need to worry about it too much. I think just do it first and later just be honest and straightforward. It will work out.
That's good. Do you know Topi Canova? Topi. Do you know Topi Canova?
Topi.
Yeah.
Sorry, I don't know. But my name is Jeremias, and I'm the developer of Django Bitcoin library.
Which one?
Django Bitcoin. It's.
Do you want to spell it for people so they know?
Django for Python, the web framework.
Oh, Django.
Okay, and yeah. I have also this small service, easywallet.org.
Yeah, I've seen Easy Wallet.
Cool. Yeah, so it's meant for like service which is the most easy way to use Bitcoins.
Cool, so that's easywallet.org and Bitcoin plugin for Python Django.
Yeah. How do I buy physical goods with Bitcoins if the merchant doesn't deliver?
That's interesting. You said you're asking how you can buy a cup of coffee or what?
Yeah, a book.
A book, yeah.
But if I don't get sent the book, my Bitcoin is gone. So what do I do?
I'm just trying to find. Oh, fuck. I got so many badges and stuff in my bag that it's hard to find my. What I'm looking for. Oh man, there's so much junk here. This is insane. Whatever, I lost it. Can't find it, it's lost. So I don't see. So, like, let's say you make a payment to someone in a shop using PayPal, and it goes through instantly. There's no problem there, right? So the thing is, so SEPA payments, okay? It's SEPA means, you know, single European payments area, and the way a SEPA payment works is that it goes through a clearing and settlements mechanism. Now, without getting too much into how financial systems work, a settlement clearing system exists because typically the cycle time to finalize transactions is much longer than actually it takes to make a transaction. So when you make a transaction, it goes through a clearing system, but every so often, and it differs per country, like in the US, it's maybe every day, at the end of the day, the settlements mechanism comes and finalizes it. So Bitcoin really is a settlements mechanism. It's not a clearing mechanism. Clearing mechanisms are something that, as I said, you know, we need to build more infrastructure on top of Bitcoin because it's still a very early system. It's something that's going to come later on top. Any more questions?
I could very well imagine that governments would like to ban Bitcoins. Are there any practical possibilities to for them to reach that goal?
All right, maybe I can show. Ooh, my screensaver's cool. All right, let's see. Oh, I have no internet here, I think. No? Yeah, I have no internet. All right, let me try one sec. So one of the things is you said like how Bitcoin, even if the entire infrastructure on top of this base system, which is the Bitcoin protocol, the Bitcoin network, was shut down, that wouldn't ever stop Bitcoin from functioning. It could literally function without the... Oh, okay, fine. All right. Yeah, the Bitcoin system could exist without exchanges, without clearing systems, without whatever. It could just exist as the Bitcoin network with people trading Bitcoins between themselves for fiat currency. Because there will always need to exist the kind of transactions that can't be done through the conventional financial system. So I mentioned before about the Silk Road. I also neglected to mention there are assassination markets where people can put politicians up to be assassinated. But on the brighter side of that coin is that when WikiLeaks had their PayPal, their MasterCard, their Visa, their Swiss bank, their Amazon, and their DNS shut down within a single day because of pressure from the DOJ, the only form of payment that they could accept was Bitcoins. That was their only source of income. And those transactions, those type of transactions will always need a conduit. There will always be a demand for a conduit. And where that demand exists, there will exist a demand for Bitcoins. And where's the demand for Bitcoins? That gives Bitcoin its value.
Can Bitcoins be converted to normal money?
Yeah, sure.
How does this work?
It works like I have 10 Bitcoins and you have 10 euros and you want 10 Bitcoins and I want 10 euros and we do a swap. It's the price of Bitcoin is set by the market. And there are marketplaces where people can go and do this trading and it's automated. But then there are also things like, maybe I can show you Bitcoin OTC. So maybe this will give you a more intuitive sense for how... Bitcoin's work in practice. So let me see. So look, there's an order book, of people. So this guy's selling, you know, PayPal USD, euros. Some people selling euros, USD. You know, do a trade with them, get your bitcoins. That's how it works. Any more questions? Yeah.
You said that Bitcoin is a distributed timestamp contract system, which is a settlement mechanism and not a clearing mechanism.
Yeah.
Could you tell us, please, a bit more about the nuts and bytes behind this whole mathematic stuff, please, in simple words? And the other question, what was this documentary with this Lauren Carpenter and with
the documentary is called All Saved by Machine... Machines Saved from Loving Grace or something.
And who's it from? BBC or probably?
Yeah, yeah, it's BBC, but it's...
Because I know this voice. It's from the same
Adam
guy.
Curtis.
Ah, Power of Nightmare.
Yeah, yeah, the same
okay,
guy.
Thanks.
But he says a lot of silly things in the documentary.
Well, I'd like to see it for myself. Thanks.
Okay, how the Bitcoin network functions? I don't know. Shovan, do people really want me to go into how Bitcoin works? It'd take 10 minutes, maybe.
Well, that's what I'm here for.
All right. Okay. So, in BitTorrent, when you want to download a file of someone else, you connect to that person, you start downloading that movie off of that person. Right? You find the other person in that network, you start downloading it off of them. Now imagine that if everybody in the network was all downloading the same file, a movie, if you will, of the story of transactions in the Bitcoin system since the network's inception. So there was this concept called hashcash where if I have 10 whatever currency, 10 bitcoins, and you give me your public key, I can write a contract that says, you know, this entitles Ben to 10 bitcoins, and I sign it using my private key over to his public key. And then if he wants to send it to someone else, he can take that contract, he can add to the bottom, saying that he now signs it over to, you know, John, to John's public key, and he signs it with his private key. And so you have a clear history of the chain of transactions since the beginning, which was with me. But this problem, you know, it was a long history of people thinking, you know, how can we solve the money problem? You know, the hacker movement was thinking, how can we solve the money problem? But there is a problem with that scheme, and it's the double spending problem. It's that if I send money to Ben, I can at the same time send money to Barry. And there's no easy way to see which person I sent it to. The classical scheme for stopping this was that you relied on a central authority. The central authority says which transaction is kosher and which is not. So that's what that big file that you're downloading in the network is. It's a database of all of the history of all of the transactions since the network's inception. And that database is an authoritative database. The transactions in there are the transactions that are in the network. Now, when you make a transaction, that transaction goes into the network and it floats around until somebody creates a block. And this block gets added to the end of this database. This database is append only, and it only ever expands in a series of blocks. So, in fact, the database is a series of blocks. That's why it's called the blockchain. Now, to make a block is not easy. There was this question in the 80s about, like, how can we stop spammers, and someone came up with this proposal that, you know, okay, spammers send thousands or millions of emails, whereas we send maybe a few dozen. If every email had a very small cost associated with it, for us, that cost would be negligible. But for a spammer, it would be too much, that it wouldn't be profitable for them to spam. And the whole idea was that the way you could create this cost was that when you send an email to someone else, the server responds back with a mathematical problem. Now, this mathematical problem is difficult to solve, but easy to verify. So you try to solve this problem, your computer tries to solve this problem, what does it do? It's using processor power. And if it's using processors, cycles, to solve this problem, then it's using electricity. And if it's using electricity, then electricity costs money. So you've just made a small cost for an email. And then you respond back with the solution to the problem. The server can easily verify that. And then they accept your email. That proposal did not get taken up eventually because there was some worry that, you know, it would stop legitimate spam, like newsletters. So in Bitcoin, when you make these blocks, you have to solve this mathematical problem. What the problem is defined in the protocol, but it is varied according to some parameter by the network, which is called the difficulty. So, and that varying of the parameter is determined algorithmically. Still with me? Yeah? Okay, good. So you've got now a chain of blocks, and I call it a block. It's called a blockchain, but that's actually a bit of a misnomer. It's more like a tree of blocks, but it's a tree with small stubby branches. And the authoritative chain is always the chain that took the most amount to compute, and usually that's just the longest chain, the chain with the most amount of blocks in it. So let's say I make a payment, and that payment goes into... One second. Okay, let's say I make a payment, and that payment goes into a block. And then other people come and start building on top of that block, like so. And if an attacker wants to reverse this block, to reverse that payment, to double spend that payment, not only does he have to reverse this block, he has to reverse this block, this block, this block, this block, this block, all this block, until he gets down to this block. And he has to try and compute an alternative chain from the block before it while the rest of the network is already moving ahead of him at the same time. Now, you can actually model, because how a block is solved is not deterministic, is like kind of a lottery. It is probabilistic. You can model it as a coin flip. So you can say that if an attacker has 10% of the total network power in the network, you can say it's like a coin flip where the attacker has a 10% chance of heads and the network has a 90% chance of tails. So, one thing is to say that the amount of computational power in the Bitcoin network right now is bigger than any supercomputer in the world. So, if I just show you... Not loading? Okay. So we model an attacker who's trying to create an alternative chain, and let's say, and he can maybe get a lurch quickly early on, but you can show, if you use the gambler's risk of ruin, which is an equation, which is, you know, a game theory game used to model if I have a euro and you have a euro and we do a coin flip, and then you win my euro, how long does it take for me to become bankrupt? Well, you know, I can either lose that euro on the first round, or I can win another euro, and I now have 2 euros, and then I would have to lose that 2 euro twice, and then if I win a euro, and I have to lose it 3 times. And so if you model that using a Poisson distribution, you very quickly see that as the number of blocks increases, when someone computes a block, the chance of an attacker reversing blocks very quickly drops exponentially close to zero, practically to zero. And so what that means is it's practically impossible, after a sufficient amount of blocks have come along, a sufficient amount of confirmations, to reverse a payment. And so yeah, that's basically, I think, how Bitcoin works. I might have missed out some details. Any more questions?
Hi there.
Hi.
Following on from what you're just saying, presumably to make the network absolutely secure, you have to be devoting more than 50% of the computing power on the planet to it. Is that correct?
No, not on the planet.
Why not? Because otherwise, if large enough governments group
maybe,
together...
Maybe in some theoretical sense, right?
Okay, but well, let's say 10% of the computing on the planet or something, because the US government could marshal quite a lot of computers if they put their mind to it.
It's just enough computing power that it makes the cost of an attack impractical.
And right, but let's say that, what are the environmental implications of this? Because you're just burning those CPU cycles, aren't you?
Well, okay, let's think about the alternative as it exists now, right? We have to chop down trees. We have to take those trees to factories. We have to print money. We have to put them in cars, transport them to buildings in institutions that are heated with employees. And then those are transported to banks where there are people in banks. There's an enormous amount of waste there. So when to say that Bitcoin is environmentally unfriendly, no, it's far better environmentally than what exists now.
Well, okay, if you're assuming that all paper, all money is based on paper, then that your argument would stand. Anyway, what was the other question I was going to ask you? Damn. Sorry. Carry on.
Okay, you could maybe just go remember and then come back after and be cool. Questions? No? Cool.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Go.
On the OTC thing, yeah. So if you're doing a transaction regularly with someone where you fancy, you know, if I wanted to run a business accepting bitcoins, I have to go and find someone that I trust a bit to give me cash in exchange for the bitcoins if I want to go and buy some bread at the local corner shop, probably. So I start doing these transactions with some random person I don't really know, and somewhere else there's another pair of people probably doing the same transaction. If the government then looks at the two endpoints of that, it could be that the person that's sending me money is receiving drugs from the person that's doing the mirroring deal at the other end. So what they see when the police go and knock on this guy's door is that he receives drugs from somewhere in the post and he keeps on sending me money.
Yeah.
How does one deal with that?
Well, you know, cash... Drug dealers use cash, right?
Yeah, but they don't normally send it to someone that isn't involved in the drug deal.
Right. So the way it works with cash, though, is that if you have knowledge that that money is the product of, you know, crime, then you are criminally negligent, and you are negligent under the law, and you are the law applies to you. But if you don't have knowledge, then you're fine. It's the same with bitcoins, right?
Yeah, I'm not really concerned about the Bitcoin bit of this. I'm concerned about the fact that
when they
go to the various bank accounts, they'll see lots of transactions towards me in exchange for drugs delivered.
Oh, right. So you were saying like you gave your drug dealer, dealer.
The drug dealer is sending me Bitcoins indirectly for some computer programming that I did.
Okay, yeah, that's what I was saying, though. With cash, if a drug dealer gave you cash and you did not know he was a drug dealer, that's fine. The law does not apply to you.
Absolutely.
The same with Bitcoin.
Are the authorities liable to just not notice the Bitcoins in that transaction? That's what I was wondering.
Well, you're not criminally liable. You're off the hook. The drug dealer is criminally liable because he's selling drugs. So that's
how I get that. It's just that as far as if you follow the money, the money is coming into my pockets even though I've never seen the drugs and I didn't know the guy was a user who's paying me. So I was just wondering how one would deal with that.
Okay, well, if you decided that you want to anonymize your money, you could use a mixing service. So that's one thing you could
do. That makes it a bit difficult to put your Bitcoin wallet on your bank, on your website, saying, yeah, I accept Bitcoin for business.
Wait, what's the question? So I was saying that...
If I run a legitimate business,
yeah,
and I publish a wallet, so then I'm receiving Bitcoins, but I need to be able to spend the Bitcoins. The local businesses around me that supply vegetables don't take Bitcoins. So I then have to find a partner in the market somehow who is going to give me cash for Bitcoins. Now, what are they using those Bitcoins for? I don't know, but... When the authorities go and check out that person because they keep on receiving drugs in the post, I had no knowledge of that, they're going to see all the money going from their bank account to my bank account. And they're not going to see the Bitcoins coming in for the legitimate work I was doing. They're going to see the money coming from this scumbag, it turns out, but I didn't know that because I never met them before. I got them up on OTC.
But
do you see the problem?
But your addresses are you private, so what's the problem? Like, they don't know who you are. They know it goes to some guy, but like...
No, they see a financial transaction. Unless I get the money in the post, in which case they'll have gone to the post, the letterbox, and seen the money I'm talking about. The police are going to look at the money. The police aren't even going to know about
it. So now you're saying that they'd send you Bitcoin through the post, right?
No, I'm not. I'm saying when you try and cash in your Bitcoins for cash,
yeah,
you have to do a transaction with someone, don't you?
Right.
And they have to be wanting something in Bitcoins.
Right.
And one of the most popular things to buy with Bitcoins is drugs, as you were saying earlier.
No, I don't know about that.
Well, you sort of said it.
I said it.
Therefore, why do they... There's a reasonable percentage chance that they will want the Bitcoins to feed their habit. So, when they get investigated... The police are going to see drugs arriving through the post, and they're going to see either postal, you know, envelope stuff with cash going into the local letterbox, or they're going to see transactions coming out of that person's bank account and going somewhere. And if that somewhere is me,
then the
next thing that happens is I get a knock on the door.
Okay, well then you should not use the OTC, right? You should go for a legitimate exchange. So there, it is actually... If I exchange with someone €1,000 for £1,000, right, that is kind of illegal or dodgy because, you know, I am now... So the way the money laundering law works is let's say bad money originates in one place and then it goes to an endpoint. All of the financial processors along that chain are punished, with the most severely at this end, and... maybe not at all at this end.
Yeah.
So if you're exchanging large amounts of Bitcoins, which would hold you criminally liable or negligent, the first thing is that you should be doing your due diligence. So in financial terms, that's called KYC, know your customer. That means you are not exchanging money with some dodgy character, but someone that you know their identity. You are pretty sure that the funds have come from legitimate places. This is something that is not to do with Bitcoin. This is like something to do with euros or dollars or whatever.
What I'm saying
But what you should do then is go for an established, registered, regulated financial institution to exchange Bitcoins if you want to be well within the law. And there are many exchanges like that.
Yeah, okay.
Like, yeah, Intersango is one of them. And there are others.
And how do those exchanges deal with that? Because then
because
the intermediary...
They interface with the banks, right? So the banks have to do KYC. And then if someone changes Bitcoins to pounds, yeah, there is one party on there that's known.
Okay.
Yeah. One more question? If you want
to... You said that Bitcoin is a decentralized system.
Yeah.
So that means I'm storing my value or my Bitcoins, I'm storing locally.
Yeah, on your hard drive.
On my own computer. So that means then that I am subject to hacker attacks myself. So I have to defend myself against people stealing my bitcoins.
Yeah, that's why security policy is far better.
But is that always better than
having
money
in the bank?
Are
you joking? Would you want your Linux computer to be owned by a third party who told you, oh yeah, we're going to secure it for your benefit, you know?
Is it always better? In some ways, it seems like I'm storing the money under the mattress.
Here's the difference.
Rather than having money in the bank.
Choice. If you want to trust a third party, you can. You can go to a third party and say, hey, store my bitcoins for me. Do all that stuff that banks do that I like. But if you don't want to do that, if you don't trust banks to not engage in fraud, to not expose themselves to unnecessary risk, to not take on excessive amounts of toxic assets, then you can secure bitcoins according to your own policy, according to what level you choose. That's the difference here, right? The security policy is up to you, not up to a third party.
But I then have to become a security expert.
No, you get to choose what level of security involvement you want. It's like with a Linux desktop, right? It's the same principle. Linux gives you the choice, you know, like when you install Ubuntu, you're not meant to use a command line. You're not meant to configure your system startup program, but if you want to, you can. You can change systemv to upstart. You can choose to use a command line, whatever.
Yeah, but people do have their, people have had their machines compromised, and is it the Bitcoin wallet?
Sure, there was a guy who had $500,000 worth of Bitcoin stolen, and this guy was an idiot. He was storing his Bitcoin wallet on a Windows computer that he knew had viruses and Trojans on, and it inevitably got stolen. And a lot of the problems with Bitcoin now is that the technology is still very early. There is not many established ways of dealing with Bitcoins appropriately.
But then this becomes an arms race then of the people with bitcoins against hackers, and the hackers see there's always more value in attacking people because more people have bitcoins.
So you're saying that security is never possible?
Well,
it's like saying, why should we have computers, you know? We can't secure them. Everyone's going to break in and steal our data, you know? Yeah. Come on,
But it's anybody's machine can be hacked.
Sure.
So I'm not sure of the risks. I'm not sure of the safety of the system.
Well, Bitcoin system never been compromised, never found a flaw in the Bitcoin system so far. Well, there have been flaws, but nothing that can lead to stealing bitcoins.
But people have had their machines hacked. And
people
their
who had
stolen.
Bitcoin. All right, if I have credit card details on my computer, someone steals those credit card details and clears out my bank account, that is not a problem with the US dollar. That is a problem with your security practices, right? Is that?
Yeah.
If someone clears out my PayPal account.
But a lot of other assets, it's easier to control them because they are more the physical assets, like a credit card.
No way, it's more easier to control bitcoins. Tell it to someone who's been working with banks and financial industry for the last 2 years. It's impossible to work with them. They're ludicrously inefficient. They don't know what they're doing, really. There are, you know, today, our business bank account, we have to stop now, but yeah, there are too many problems with the banking system to be able to use in any scalable large way. It's just not feasible.
Yeah, okay, thanks.
No worries.